So I also want to acknowledge my other co-authors on this project, including Yvonne Commodore Mensa and my dissertation advisor, Cheryl Dennison Himmelfarb, who's contributed a lot in terms of helping me develop my ideas that went into this paper. And I have no disclosures. And so as we're probably all fairly familiar with a lot of common behavioral theories like social cognitive theory and theory of planned behavior, and are aware that a lot of those theories state that the social environment influences health behavior and behavior change. But the theories are relatively underdeveloped when it comes to ideas of how the social environment actually influences behavior and behavior change. In particular, if you look at social cognitive theory, there's an idea that the social environment is a key factor in that sort of triadic relationship that we probably are all pretty familiar with. And yet it's defined differently in different settings, and that can be beneficial in some ways to be useful in terms of tailoring to setting, and yet it also leaves us with a bit of a black box when it comes to really understanding what are the key components of communities, neighborhoods, and social contexts in which people live, and what are the active components that actually influence their behavior, and what are the components that we could more powerfully leverage when it comes to behavior change. And so there are obviously some gaps in understanding the social environment and how that influences behavior. A lot of social level factors are not well defined. If you do a sort of a, just as an example, if you do a quick PubMed search of self-efficacy, you'll get over 27,000 hits. If you do a PubMed search of collective efficacy, which is really a more community level variable or aggregate variable, you'll get only about 160 hits. And so these concepts are not well utilized or well defined, and we don't really understand the relationships between them or how they influence individual level behavior. And so the purpose of our project is really sort of to look at that a little bit more explicitly. And we feel that this would be helpful to improve not just theories, but also interventions, as I said earlier, to help us leverage the power of the social environment, since we know that social norms are so powerful in people's lives, and social support also, and a lot of those commonly used terms are so powerful in people's lives. And it also can be helpful to address more, to create more multi-level interventions. The IOM has called for more multi-level interventions. And this would be helpful to find interventions that could really target those variables at community levels. And so one concept that's gained increasing attention and that you actually just heard about in the previous talk is community social capital. And it's defined differently in different settings, but the overall idea behind it is that community social capital is beneficial for health. There have been a lot of studies that show that that higher rates of community social capital are associated with decreased rates of mortality and improved self-rated health and other health outcomes. And yet the pathways that lead to those health outcomes are not well understood. And there's also some literature to show that community social capital may not always be associated with beneficial health outcomes, especially when you're dealing with more sort of proximal health characteristics and disease pathways. And since there are numerous definitions out there, so social capital might be defined according to the structure of your social networks, sort of similarly to what we heard in the presentation just a moment ago, where you're describing your group membership or describing your relationship with other people and maybe what they do and how you might get access to resources because of those social networks. But it also can be described in terms of the function of the group itself. And so that was sort of something that we focused on, is the function of the social network, and in particular, how that might sort of create enhanced social support or other resources that somebody could draw upon. And so we use the definition established by Bourdieu in the 1980s. He's a sociologist, and there's a lot of sociological literature on social capital in general, and so we sort of drew from that and tried to apply it more to behavioral theories or at the sort of studies that are out there. And so Bourdieu's idea is that these resources that are available in networks could be drawn upon by someone in a time of need, and it might include anything from sort of social support or just the expectation that you could trust someone or expect help from someone, called reciprocal helpfulness, or just having a positive sense about your community or your social group in which you interact on a daily basis, which gives you some sense of sort of self-efficacy or pleasure. So the purpose of our study was to survey the use of community social capital related concepts in the health promoting behavior literature, and secondly, to also use that literature and the theoretical literature available to propose a conceptual framework that would allow us to integrate those concepts better into behavioral theories, and with the idea that over time, with testing and further refinement of the theories, that we would be able to have more sort of community-level concepts, in addition to just social capital, that might be usable and testable in our interventions. So to start out, we did a systematic literature search with librarian consultation, and we tried to sort of spread our net fairly widely in terms of social capital related concepts and identify how the literature was defining those concepts. And so we took all of the available studies and two of the authors, basically coded each of the studies and categorized them according to how social capital was defined in that paper. And so once we had done that, then we set up sort of almost headings for each of those different categories based on the empirical literature and how they operationalized social capital, and based on the theoretical literature, making sure that we were sort of just staying true to how social capital has otherwise been used in theory and sociology and other fields. And so here are our results. So we found 53 studies that looked at health-promoting behaviors. The vast majority of them, as you can see, looked at physical activity. Quite a few of them looked at smoking, so that might be current smoking status or smoking cessation. And a couple of them, only two, looked at fruit and vegetable intake. The vast majority of them were randomly sampled groups. A lot of these were cross-sectional data from either cohort studies or case control studies. Mostly cohort studies. Some of them were from baseline data from randomized controlled trials, but we didn't include any post-treatment data in this. And they were drawn from a variety of countries, but most of the research has been done in the U.S. And as I said earlier, most of the data is really cross-sectional. And so these are some of the concepts that were used in literature. And sort of a minimalist, as you may have gathered when it comes to slides, but I'd be happy to supply more references if anybody wants them. But so these are some of the sort of key concepts that came up frequently in social capital-related literature. The first is trustworthiness, which is fairly self-explanatory and simply the ability to trust someone in your social network. And again, this is community-specific, so it would simply be whether you felt you could trust someone within your community simply because they were in your community, and regardless of whether you had an actual relationship with them. And again, because this is really a community-level concept, theoretically, this should be a characteristic of the community group as a whole and not dependent necessarily on individual relationships. The second was neighborly reciprocity, and again, we're talking about community-level variables here, and so it's the ability to expect help from someone in your community, maybe a neighbor or someone else in time of need. If you needed somebody to take care of your kids or give you a ride, could you expect that somebody would help you out? And neighborhoods vary in terms of how much that is normative. And so there's actually quite a few studies that looked at the level of neighborhood reciprocity that was expected. The third is sense of community, which is simply this idea that community members care about each other and are committed to each other. And it's thought to sort of foster a sense of belonging in individuals and a sort of positive perception of their community. And there are some other related concepts. So these are not necessarily social capital concepts, but they are sort of interact with social capital, and so we also drew some results from these for these concepts as well. The first is simply behavioral norms. So those are social norms that would support a particular behavior, and they may support physical activity, which would be a health-promoting behavior. They may actually support a harmful behavior, like smoking. And the second is collective efficacy, and we sort of drew from Bandura's work here, looking at collective efficacy, and he defines it as the ability to achieve shared community goals. And Samson has also done quite a bit of work in collective efficacy as it pertains to neighborhoods. And so traditionally in the theoretical literature, it's considered to consist of two things, social control and social cohesion. And social control is defined as the willingness of neighbors to intervene for the public good. A lot of this relates to sort of issues that might arise with children and whether you would help protect children if they were in need on the street, or whether you might even scold them if they were doing something wrong, like spraying graffiti or something like that. The second is social cohesion, which is the solidarity amongst neighbors and whether they sort of band together, and that would allow them to achieve their goals together. And so these are some of the results that we found. If you sort of summarize all of the relationships that were found statistically significant in the literature, as you can see, modeling is one form of behavioral norms, which is simply asking people whether they see other people being active in their neighborhood. And in general, modeling was associated with a greater likelihood of engaging in that behavior that you saw, which is fairly intuitive. And yet one study also found that that result was actually turned around. So in a group of Latino women, they were actually less likely to be physically active if they saw other women being physically active in their neighborhood, which we thought was sort of interesting. And there were a couple of other studies that looked at other, that measured norms in other ways. And so a couple of them looked at count or prevalence data, which were more sort of objective measures of social norms. And a couple of them also looked at perceived norms, asking people what they thought was normative for their neighborhood. Do you think that people support smoking, or do you think that people support physical activity? And again, what you would see is that if people saw an activity taking place, they were more likely to engage in it, or if the behavior was normative in some way, they were more likely to engage in it overall. And so these are sort of the key social capital concepts. As you can see here, there were, again, we sort of separated them according to health promoting or disease promoting, or whether there was no association at all. And as you can see, the vast majority of studies really found no association, and which is interesting because these are sort of representative samples for the most part. But there were differences according to which social capital concept was used. And so in general, trustworthiness was associated with more health-promoting behaviors, whereas neighborly reciprocity didn't really seem to have any sort of pattern across the studies in terms of how it was associated with health-promoting behaviors. And having a sense of community was associated with more health-promoting behaviors in some studies, but it was not statistically significant in the vast majority of them. And interestingly, for collective efficacy, if you look at the relationships here, again, you can see I think the most interesting part of this is looking at the fact that sometimes collective efficacy is associated with greater rates of disease-promoting behaviors, so increased rates of smoking or decreased rates of physical activity, and that sometimes we could see differences in the results according to how collective efficacy or social cohesion or social control were measured. And so it depended on whether individual or neighborhood aggregate results were used. It also depended according to sex or race sometimes. And so if we sort of summarize the, I think, the unexpected findings are the most interesting. If you sort of look at those, one study was a convenience sample, so it might just be not representative of general studies. But the other studies were all representative. And if you look at all three of these studies, you can see that these are individuals who may not necessarily relate to the broader society. So adolescents, Latinas, and older adults. And so it could be that they didn't perceive the norms to be relevant to them, or they couldn't somehow access the social capital that was available in their communities. There could be any number of reasons for that if they're sort of a more alienated group. And the other interesting point and sort of potential reason for these findings would be if norms actually supported a higher rate of the activity. And so in Taiwan, it's fairly common for, or more common than it is here in the U.S., for men to smoke. And so once the, this was a Taiwanese study, which found increased rates of smoking associated with social capital. And once they controlled for individual level factors, that relationship went away. And so it could be simply that it was normative for men to smoke, but once you controlled for sex, that relationship diminished. And so based on that, we sort of developed a conceptual framework, which I'll leave up here for opportunities for discussion. Based on the theory that we drew from sociology, social epidemiology, and other fields, which emphasized not just individual intention, but also the potential pathways of socialization and the power of social norms. And so I'll leave it open for any comments or questions. So I'll repeat the question in case you couldn't hear. So the question was, with the growing use of technology, how would sort of online social networks relate to this study? That's a good question. I think online communities would potentially differ in some ways than neighborhood communities, because people don't always choose their neighborhoods, and they are more likely to choose their online social networks. And so you might associate yourself with someone that already agrees with you and you already believe in and would seek support from. And so the potential effects of that on your behavior are probably just going to encourage you to do the kind of behavior you wanted to do anyway. So there might potentially be some differences there, but that's a good question. Yeah. Prevalence? Yeah. So individual behavior would be sort of the box at the bottom. And this is sort of a whole other, it's sort of spelled out more in the paper, which hopefully will be available soon. But the idea is that there's a difference between individual behavior and sort of the level of the behavior prevalence in a community. And there's some evidence, the Framingham study, Nicholas Christakis' work looks at sort of behavior change at a community level and across social networks, and where they see sort of behavior change en masse in communities. So people just sort of all quitting smoking together, for example, whole groups of people. And so I think that that's sort of another area that has yet to be explored in terms of behavior change. And I think if we're starting to talk about community level concepts, we should also think about the potential, at least, that it might have for inducing behavior change, not just at an individual level, but also at the community level as well. Yeah. Very. Mm-hmm. No, they're different. And so you have to account for that in multi-level modeling or other sort of sophisticated statistical techniques and understand what exactly you're talking about. So if you're dealing with sort of prevalence of social community, of community social capital availability, then you probably would be more likely to talk about prevalence of behavior change on the other end and just deal with everything at a community level. If you're talking about both levels, then you do have to account for that potential for clustering within communities and the fact that people within communities would have similar results. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so there is, the Project on Human Development in Chicago was done started 20 years ago or something, and it's a fairly classic study. So if you just sort of Google SAMHSA, he has a measurement tool for collective efficacy, which does include those two components. So it has a few questions on social cohesion and a few questions on social control.